Hi, Nancy. Jim Daly here, along with John Fuller.
Hello.
And we wanted to say thanks for joining us for the Focus on the Family broadcast, which was titled, How Dehumanizing Beliefs Shape Our Culture. You've so brilliantly combined science and scripture to combat this pervasive, destructive concept of mind-body dualism.
Yeah, and that conversation struck a chord with our listeners. In fact, so much so that it was one of our highest response programs of the year.
Thank you again for making this program such a success, and I wish you and Richard God's greatest blessings in 2026.
The Christian message starts with creation, that we have very high dignity and high value because we're made in God's image, and that should be our starting point. Even on these sexuality issues, that God created sexuality and it's therefore good.
That's professor and author Nancy Piercy, and she has insights about how devaluing our bodies is a really hidden force behind so many of the cultural issues we see today. This is Focus on the Family with Jim Daly, and thanks for joining us. I'm John Fuller, and this program isn't going to be suitable for younger listeners as we discuss some pretty serious topics.
You know, so much of our life, John, is the behaviors that we adopt are things that we typically catch as opposed to being taught. You know, caught over taught, yeah. That's what we talk about. We talk a lot about that when it comes to parenting. You know, your kids are going to watch you more than they're going to listen to you. And it's so important for us as Christians to model the Christian faith well and also speak of it well. Mm-hmm. And today we're going to concentrate on the aspect of the body and our sexuality that we don't typically think in that context. You know, what are our children catching? What does culture catch? Mm-hmm. Look at how we are inundated with messages when it comes to our body, our sexual appetites, etc. Yeah. And we as Christians need to be equipped to share a message of hope with a culture that is desperately in need of healing and a biblical understanding of what God has created.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it feels like we're just kind of floating out there in the sea, pushed along by the currents, but our guest believes that there is a solid foundation of truth, as God tells us, all about our bodies. And Nancy Piercy has done research. She's, as I said, a professor and a scholar in residence at Houston Christian University. She's written a number of books, some with the late, great Chuck Colson.
The late, great.
And the book that forms the foundation of our conversation today is Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality. And you can learn more about Nancy and this great book. We've got the details for you at focusonthefamily.com.
Nancy, welcome back. It's been a number of years, but it's so good to have you back here at Focus on the Family.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Now, you're teaching. That's extraordinary. I love that. And you're teaching at a university there, Houston Christian. So you see a lot of young people coming under your radar. Do you think things, you know, we always talk about the snow is deeper. We went to school uphill both ways back when we were kids. Are you seeing a real big shift in young people today from 20, 30 years ago? What do you think? What are your observations telling you?
Well, first of all, the pandemic made a big difference.
Hmm.
College students are coming in with high school level skills.
Right.
They've definitely lost a lot during the pandemic. Mm-hmm. And we're having to reteach, you know, a lot of things that high school teachers have to teach them in terms of study skills and school skills we're having to teach them. So that's one big thing. But the second thing is, you know, my book, Love Thy Body, is about the sexuality issues of abortion and homosexuality, transgenderism. And yes, every one of these students is coming in with friends and family members or maybe themselves. Yeah. Having problems in these areas. And if that wasn't the case a few years ago, it's very much the case now. Now, when I speak in my classroom about these issues, I can't say, well, you may have some friends, because they'll come up to me afterwards and they will tell me privately, well, actually, I'm struggling with same-sex attraction, or I'm struggling with gender dysphoria. So I have to be very careful in the classroom that I realize this is going to be personal to them. This is not just academic.
Yeah.
This is going to be personal.
And this is a Christian campus. And I'm not, you know, Houston Christian is not different than Biola or Asbury or a lot of other Christian campuses. These are kids coming mostly from Christian homes that have these struggles too.
And that's why they need to know what the secular worldviews are, because they're absorbing them. You know, sometimes in a Christian school, I have colleagues who say, well, we should teach the Christian worldview. And yes, you should. But they don't teach the secular ideas that our kids need to be prepared to encounter.
Right.
And then the kids don't have a critical grid.
Correct. You know,
they have to have a critical grid so when they hear non-Christian worldviews, they recognize them and can say, no, I see why this is wrong. And so many of them don't. I'll give you just one story. A student was sitting in the hallway reading a book on postmodernism. And of course, I had to stop and ask him, you know, what are you learning? And he said, I'm learning about myself. Hmm. I had no idea I had absorbed so many postmodern concepts. But this is me. I'm in this book.
Wow, that's really objective. I mean, that's wonderful. How many churches, we as church-going Christians, how many of us need to read that book, right? Let me ask you this, just for the critic who heard John give the title, Love Thy Body. What are you talking about, Nancy? You're making an idol out of our bodies? That's not at all what you're talking about. When you say love thy body, just generically, theologically, what are you saying?
Yeah, most people don't realize that the sexual issues that I deal with all have to do with the body. Let's start with the secular worldview, since we just said our children need to know that. Many people don't realize that the point of issue in the secular ideologies is the body. Let's take the most obvious example. It's transgenderism, because transgender activists argue explicitly that your gender identity has nothing to do with your body. You know, it has nothing to do with your biological sex. The BBC did a documentary called Transgender Kids, and they said, at the heart of the debate is the idea that your mind can be at war with your body. At war. And BBC also did a program for teenagers, and it featured a young teenage girl who identified as non-binary. And she said, it doesn't matter what meat skeleton you've been born in, it's your feelings that defined you. Right. So the body has been demoted to a meat skeleton.
Hmm. Yeah, which we're going to dig into that. And it's fascinating as I went through the material, read the book. And, you know, it's something, again, that we don't spend a lot of time thinking about, this separation of soul, spirit from the body and the way the world attacks the body. And it's fascinating. We're going to get there. But I want to first give people a taste of who you are. You were, I think, a self-described hippie.
Yes.
and you were kind of, you know, in that cultural groove. I'm really using the terms, aren't I? And, you know, but then you had some epiphanies along the way. Just give us a quick thumbnail of who you are and your background and how you got to faith in Christ.
Yeah, I love telling my conversion story. It's like the older I get, the more thankful I am that God got hold of me. But I was raised in a Lutheran home. It was Scandinavian Lutheran, and I don't know if you know, but it was a state church there, so all Scandinavians are Lutheran.
Okay.
It's an ethnic thing, like all Irish are Catholic. And so there wasn't a lot of personal conviction. And when I was in high school, I started asking questions. I'm in a public high school, all my textbooks are secular, all my teachers are secular. And I just started asking, well, how do we know Christianity's true?
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't get any answers. I asked a Christian college professor. Actually, I'm going to tell you, it's my dad. I don't always say this, but it was my father. He was a university professor. And so I asked him point blank, why are you a Christian? He said, works for me.
Okay.
I said, really? That's it? And I had a chance to talk to a seminary dean who was my uncle. And all he said was, don't worry, we all have doubts sometimes. As it was a psychological phase, and you would outgrow it. And so when I didn't get any answers, I finally decided about halfway through high school, I said, well, if you don't have good reasons for something, you shouldn't say you believe it, you know, whether it's Christianity or anything else. And I certainly am not getting any good reasons. And so I very consciously walked away from my Christian upbringing and decided it was up to me to find truth.
Let me ask you, you know, for those listening that may not know the Lord, they don't have a relationship with Christ, but they're tipping in. They're listening to Focus. We do survey work. We know you're there. And that's great. We want you there on YouTube or listening through a broadcast, et cetera, podcast. Speak to what was inside of you. What was the appetite? I mean, I recognize it because I had a very similar journey. But why were you seeking truth? Why was it important to you? Why weren't you your father? Works for me. What was different?
Well, I wanted to be honest. If there was no God, then I wanted to live in line with that. In other words, if there was no God, it struck me pretty quickly that then there's no meaning or purpose to life. Right? We're just, life is just a cosmic accident on a rock flying through empty space.
That's very logical.
And if there's no God, there's no foundation for ethics. You know, there's just true for me, true for you. And if there's no God, I even realized there's no foundation for truth. Like, if all I have is my puny brain and the vast scope of time and space, what makes me think I could have some sort of universal, transcendent truth? Ridiculous. That's how I thought of it as a 16-year-old. Ridiculous. So I was very quickly, you know, relativist, skeptic, and even a determinist, because in my science classes I was taught we're just complex biochemical machines anyway, with no free will. So I had absorbed all of these secular isms by the time I graduated from high school. And I had no interest in going back to Christianity. But I went to Europe. We had lived in Europe when I was a child. And so I saved my money all through high school because I wanted to go back. And that's how I ended up in sort of stumbling across Le Brie, which is in Switzerland. And Le Brie is the ministry of Francis Schaeffer. Le Brie is French for the shelter. And Schaeffer was known for his apologetics ministry. And that's the first time I ever heard any Christian apologetics. You know, apologetics just means arguments for the existence of God. I had never heard anyone make a case that there were good reasons and evidence and arguments and logic, you know, to support Christianity, and that it could hold its own against the secular isms that I had absorbed by that time. So I was blown away. I was shocked.
So that gave you the appetite. I mean, obviously, that's when you dug in and said, okay, well, is God real? Well, I mean, that kind of is the core question.
Well, actually, at first I left.
Oh. Irritated?
No, I stayed a month. No, it was the opposite. It was so appealing. I had never met intellectually engaged Christians. I never met Christians who could talk to me on my level because I was so involved. I did not start studying philosophy as an academic interest. I started studying it because I thought, well, isn't that their job? The philosopher's job is to ask questions like, what is truth? And how do we know it? Mm-hmm. And is there a foundation for ethics? In the public high school I attended, I literally started walking down the hallway to the library and pulling books off the philosophy shelf.
Right.
Since I couldn't get any adult in my life to talk to me about this, I thought, well, maybe these dead white guys can help me out. And so that's why I started studying philosophy.
Well, I appreciate that appetite and that hunger. And I think that is a true pathway. I mean, I think the Lord puts that hunger in all of us that are really seeking truth. And that, to me, is the differentiator between a blind, spiritually blind person, and they can be in the church, versus somebody who really wants to know. And I know a lot of non-believers that do have that appetite, and it's wonderful to engage them and talk with them and have that Le Brie kind of experience in your own neighborhood. You know, and talk with them about why we believe the evidence for Christ is so powerful.
Exactly. You know, I had friends who were having questions about their faith, but they would stick around the church for social reasons, you know, for the friendships, you know, and I didn't want to do that. You know, I aspired to be Bertrand Russell. Do you remember the famous atheist? Yeah. Bertrand Russell said that if you're an atheist, you must build your life on the scaffolding of unyielding despair.
Yeah, what a thing to aim for.
And I thought, well, if that's true.
Yeah, but it is true.
If there's no God, I want that. Hmm. I don't want anything that's, you know, sort of an emotional cover-up. I want to know what's really true.
Well, Nancy, I think that really sets that foundation. So as people are listening, they know where you're coming from, which is an appetite for truth, which I, again, so appreciate. Let's go back to my comment about the caught and taught, how sexuality, in addition to all the kind of the virtues and the values that, especially we in a Christian family, what we're trying to do to demonstrate the faith to our kids, et cetera, speak to that idea that on the sexual side, these things are also caught more than taught. You know, most of us, at least when I went through high school, I think I was a freshman, you had to take a human sexuality class. It was very anatomical. It was very, you know, biological in function. We didn't talk about the spirit, the soul, or anything like that. It's just the function of reproduction, and they think that's enough. And then, of course, mom and dad are supposed to have the talk with you, and I didn't get that either. But speak to the caught versus taught, how the culture is telling us what sexuality is all about.
Well, yeah, let me say that, you know, when you talk about schools teaching just the biological side, now they don't. Now schools are teaching transgenderism and homosexuality.
Well,
and
teaching
it's all
or
about
affirming?
Gender. It's
both.
It's in the classroom,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, I mean, they're affirming it.
There was a news story not long ago of a first grader who came home and said, "Mommy, my teacher says just because you have boy parts doesn't mean you're a boy. Just because you have girl parts doesn't mean you're a girl." So she said to her mom, "What am I? Please take me to a doctor so we can find out what I am."
Yeah.
And the reason I know about it is because it was the news, because the parents were taking the school to court and suing them for emotional distress. But that's what's happening in the schools now. Don't think of it as just, oh, they're actually teaching reproduction. The vast majority of it now is gender identity and sexual orientation.
In that context in the book, you made a statement about spirit good, body bad. We need to unpack that to better understand the war against the body because of the fruit that delivers to the secularists. So this dividing of the body being bad and the person being good.
Yeah, well, one reason we have not recognized that this is the point of conflict with the secular world is because in the Christian world, we kind of have it too. We have the sacred secular split, where we tend to think, oh, spiritual things are good, you know, church, Bible study, that's in the religious sphere, that's the sacred sphere, and those things are good. But we often think of the ordinary life as being sort of second class, not so important, and, you know, this world's going to end anyway. And so one of my students put it this way: growing up in the church, I was always taught spirit good, body bad.
Huh.
And when I say that to audiences, I get a lot of head nods.
Yeah.
Because that sort of summarizes it. And C.S. Lewis had a great answer to that. He said, "There's no use being more spiritual than God. God invented matter. He likes it." And so that kind of encapsulates my book, you know, that as Christians, we should have a high view of the body because it's a handiwork of God. And we are known, let's face it, we're known for having a negative approach. Don't do it. It's a sin. It's against the Bible. And there's something wrong with you. And so my whole book is about how we can train ourselves to use more positive language, starting with creation, you know, that God created the body, God created sexuality, and it is therefore intrinsically good. Genesis says over and over again, "And God saw that it was good." And after the creation of man and woman, it says, "Very good." Mm-hmm. And so I train people to use the language of honoring my body. The reason this Christian sex ethic honors the body, shows us how to live in harmony with our body. It shows us how to live in tune with who God created us to be. And I have found that this is the most difficult thing for Christians to get their mind around, is just start with positive language. In other words, starting with the language of creation. You might put it this way. Most of our messages start with a fall. You're a sinner. You need to get saved. You know, the sort of classic revivalist message. And that's true. But if that's our main focus, especially young people, they come to me in my classrooms and say that in the churches they were taught they were worthless, that they were nothing, that they were corrupt, you know, that they're naturally evil. Well, they're starting with a fall. The Christian message starts with creation, that we have very high dignity and high value because we're made in God's image. Mm. And that should be our starting point, even on these sexuality issues, that God created sexuality and it's therefore good.
Nancy, this concept of devaluing the body, I think this is so important. So we're, you know, this is what we're talking about today from your book, Love Thy Body. Being a professor of college students, a good description or illustration of this, I think, I didn't experience this as a teenager myself or a 20-something, but this idea of the hookup culture where they're actually devaluing the body as a mechanism and having to protect their emotional side just to do a sexual act. Very biological in its nature, pleasurable. But how do you see the hookup culture, even as a professor at a university? I'm sure it's happening.
Yes, even the hookup culture represents the split between the body and the person. Young people know the script, even if they don't like it much. I quote in my book a college student named Alicia, who said, "Hookups are very scripted. You learn to turn everything off except your body, and you make yourself emotionally invulnerable." And there's another college student I quote named Naomi, who said, "The mistake people make is they assume that there's two very distinct elements in a relationship, one emotional and one sexual, and they pretend like there are clean lines between them." And so young people understand that the hookup culture is asking them to engage purely physically, you know, cut off from the whole person, cut off from any hint of love or commitment. You're supposed to be able to walk away from it as if it hadn't happened. I even quote a drummer from Austin, Texas, quoted in Rolling Stone magazine, and he said, "Sex is just a piece of body touching another piece of body. It is existentially meaningless." So that's the worldview at the heart of the hookup culture. We think of it usually as, you know, let's have some rules that we give young people. No, they need to realize it's driven by a worldview that says your body is meaningless and that sex itself is a meaningless act. No wonder it's creating a trail of wounded people because they're trying to live out a secular ethic that does not fit who they really are. I quote a college psychologist who said, "The most prescribed drugs on the university campus today are birth control pills and antidepressants." And she said, "That's not a coincidence."
Wow. I mean, that's a powerful statement. Let me ask you this in that context, this philosophy of separating those two things, emotions and physical sexual contact, where is that coming from and who's it benefiting? I mean, who came up with, let's promote this?
Well, it comes from your view of nature, you know, because your body is part of nature. And so if you believe that nature is a product of blind, material, purposeless forces, then the body has no intrinsic purpose that we're morally obligated to respect. And I have a wonderful quote from a well-known public intellectual. Her name is Camille Paglia. And a lot of Christians actually read her. You're nodding. You've read her. Because she's a little bit of an iconoclastic feminist. She does not think sex is merely a social construction. She says, no. Nature made us male and female. She even says, our sexual bodies are designed for reproduction. Designed, which is an unusual word for an atheist.
Right.
But she's also well known as a lesbian. By the way, she's come out as trans now. If you've been reading her, you may not know that. She's recently come out as trans. But either way, if she says nature made us male and female, how does she justify being either lesbian or trans? And here's her answer. She writes, why not defy nature? After all, and this is a direct quote, fate, not God, has given us this flesh. We have absolute claim to our bodies and may do with them as we see fit. So do you see the logic?
Oh, yeah.
If our bodies are products of mindless, purposeless forces, they have no intrinsic purpose. They give us no moral message. They give us no clue to our identity. We may do with them as we see fit.
Well, and that's running, and we're going to get into that this time or next time. That kind of runs into the abortion debate, you know, that I have control over my body. I could take the life of the baby inside of me and justify it because I have control of my body. We'll talk about that a little later. But let me continue with this. You had in the book a counselor, I think, at UCLA who was barred from telling her students about the dangers of casual sex. Think of that. That, you know, they haul her into the academic review panel and say, you can't talk to students about the dangers of unprotected sex. What are you doing? That sounds ridiculous.
Do you realize she wrote this book anonymously because she was afraid she would lose her job?
Because that was the theme?
The theme of her book was, we are teaching young people, we were encouraging young people to engage in the hookup culture, you know, on our college campuses. We have these sex weeks where they bring in, you know, Planned Parenthood, they bring in sex toys, they bring in prostitutes, you know, they teach the message that anything goes and there's no consequences.
Wow.
And she said, I have students coming into my office all the time who are devastated by the hookup culture. Wow. And she gave one example, for example, a girl who'd had her first sexual encounter with a boy who promptly dropped her afterwards. And she was devastated. And she said, why is it that the schools don't teach us that casual sexual encounters are not healthy? And that they're emotionally destructive. So she wrote a whole book on it, on how she was not allowed to even tell her students that the hookup culture could be emotionally destructive. And She wrote it anonymously. Now, she's come out, by the way, she's come out now. It's Miriam Grossman. She's written a book on transgenderism now, so she's using her name. But she had to leave UCLA to go public with her name.
Because she's raising concerns about all of this. Mm-hmm. That's fair. Let's cover that abortion side of this, this devaluing of the human body. In abortion, as within hookup culture, it's kind of a similar theme, right? And this is where we as Christians need to connect the dots here and how this deconstruction of loving thy body, the title of your book, how they can take advantage of that division. So how does it fit with a woman's ability to rationalize the killing of her preborn baby?
Yes, today it is being applied to the woman. In other words, the relationship between mother and child is not treated as some natural, organic, intrinsic relationship. It's treated as there are actually ethicists, bioethicists, who treat the fetus as like an intruder on the woman's property.
A disease.
A parasite, you'll
hear that
language.
Something that needs medical attention.
Or the most recent is property rights. A woman has property rights to her body, and the fetus is an intruder trespassing on her property, and therefore she has the right to kill it. But actually, it first became, the body-person dualism was first applied to the fetus, actually. People like Peter Singer at Princeton were some of the early people writing on this, and they said, professional bioethicists agree that life begins at conception. You know, maybe ordinary people don't realize that yet, but professional bioethicists know that the science is just too strong to deny it. The evidence from DNA and genetics.
Right, it all starts within moments.
The fetus is obviously human from fertilization, from conception. And they will say that now openly. So how do they get around that if they want to support abortion? They'll say, well, the fetus is human biologically, genetically, physiologically, but it's not a person until sometime later.
And personhood
is actually called personhood theory. And that means that you're not a person until you have developed certain mental abilities, cognitive functioning, self-determination, autonomy, whatever. And so if you can be a human but not a person until sometime later, then clearly these are two different things. So personhood theory was actually first applied to abortion. And the idea being that if you're merely human, in quotes, merely human, you have no human rights. You know, the fetus is human, but it can be killed for any reason or no reason. It can be tinkered with genetically. It can be used for research and experiments. It can be picked through for body parts to sell, like Planned Parenthood does, and then thrown out with the other medical waste. And that's the language used in medical journals. The fetus is medical waste. And so what it means is being human is no longer enough for human rights. And so this has dramatic consequences all across the board. And of course, what's the main problem with that theory? Well, if you separate personhood from being biologically human, then what do you base it on?
Yeah, what are the standards?
Exactly.
It becomes arbitrary, subjective. Every bioethicist draws the line at a different place. You don't find any of them agreeing because it is subjective. It's
right. You have viability. You have birth. You have even some that are saying that a child could be terminated if the mother doesn't want to keep that child. Oh. I mean, that sounds absurd, infanticide, but they are talking about it now.
Exactly. I think most ordinary people would say sometime before birth. But yes, you have people now saying after birth. Crick and Watson, who are kind of household names for because they discovered DNA, both of them have publicly said that we should give the newborn 3 days of genetic testing. And only if it passes the test does it qualify for the right to life.
Mm. You know, Nancy, it takes my breath away because you think about these are the smart people in the culture. These are the professors. These are the intelligentsia, the academics. How are they so blinded spiritually to not see what this plainly is, which is the taking of innocent human life?
Well, let me quote you Peter Singer at Princeton. He says, right on his page, his website, he says, even 3 years of age is a gray area.
A gray area.
A gray area. Mm. In other words, how much cognitive functioning does a toddler have? So that's what we're up against today, is that personhood is so subjective that maybe even three-year-olds are not persons.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, Nancy, we're zeroing in, and we're going to come back next time and continue this discussion because it's so informative, and hopefully we will get to kind of the tool chest of how to equip ourselves and hopefully our children as they go off to college to be able to fend off these worldviews that are so destructive. And I love the concepts we've been talking about. But right at the end here, you worked with Chuck Colson. Chuck, of course, was the founder of Prison Fellowship, the Colson Center. I think you guys started Breakpoint together, if I remember correctly.
I was the founding editor.
Yeah, there you
I
go.
I started it.
So you were my point in mentioning all that is that you were right there talking with the man who worked in the Nixon administration, who suffered the consequences of Watergate and all of that. We know Chuck's testimony well. It's one worth reading if you don't know about it. But in that context, you think of the framers and their talk about inalienable rights, that these rights come from God, not from government. Well, how about that poor baby in the womb?
Let me give you two quotes that press that home. So I said that professional bioethicists know that the fetus is human, but it has come down to journalists as well. There's a British journalist who wrote an article in which she said, when I was pregnant, I knew my baby was human. There was no question about it.
Right. They even have T-shirts. It's a baby.
It's a baby. And then she said, but of course she wanted to support abortion still. So she said, how do I do that? How do I support abortion? And then she argued that no matter how many lives we lose to abortion, women's rights are more important. Women's rights depend on her right to control her reproduction. And here's how she put it. To support women's rights, you must be prepared to kill.
Oh, my. Yeah.
The exact words.
I'll tell you, I have a parallel story. I was meeting with the editorial board, the head of the editorial board at New York Times, and he said that very same thing. When I raised this issue of how many children need to be sacrificed. And he said, well, battles have sacrifices, and women's rights will trump a baby's right to live, and that's just part of the sacrifice. Mm-hmm. That's pretty bold.
I have another quote from another journalist who said, it's amazing that you would say it that way because she did as well, because she also said, we know the fetus is human. Come on, guys. You know, she actually castigates her fellow liberals for not acknowledging, of course, it's human. And then she said what you just said. So the fetus is indeed a life worth sacrificing.
For women's rights to choose. Right. Mm-hmm. Let me end here with this question because, again, of your connection with Chuck Colson and the political sphere and its influence. You look at Roe v. Wade. Now, thankfully, the Supreme Court has overturned that, given it back to the states. We all know that. But originally, when they decided Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court at that time argued, I think, out of the 14th Amendment, which is a interstate trade amendment, right? It's connecting, you know, the ability of one state to recognize the laws of another state. That's where they kind of rooted that, I believe. But do you think with the framers, when they wrote the Constitution, if we could, you know, bring them back to life today, what do you think as a scholar and someone who was connected to the political arena, how do you think they would view that?
Well,
idea of the Supreme Court.
The Roe v. Wade, Justin Blackmun did argue expressly and explicitly that the fetus is not a person. So it did rest on personhood theory. Hmm. In fact, he said, if we acknowledge that the fetus is a person, well, then of course they would have to have the right to life. He went so far as to say, if they were a person, we would have to give them the fetus the right to life.
You know, some would argue, oh, that's a cultural overlay. Do you think the framers, the writers of the Constitution would have said, oh, yeah, we fully intended that that could be used to eliminate children?
No, of course not.
Of course not. It's absurd.
We have to bear in mind that our founders came from Europe, from a very Christianized culture. And even the ones that were not necessarily personal Christians, they were maybe more deist, had a very Christian worldview. And in fact, until roughly the 1960s, most Americans had a basically Christian worldview, even if they were not personally committed to Christianity. It wasn't that long ago that our neighbors didn't want their kids sleeping around. Their neighbors didn't want their kids drinking and doing drugs. They didn't want their kids being trans or gay. But now our neighbors disagree with us on all of these issues.
Right.
So it's been very, very recent. And you mentioned, you know, preparing our kids for going to college. Hey, preparing our kids to go to first grade.
Right.
The Washington Post recently quoted a first grade curriculum in which teachers were told to tell their students, you might be a boy even if you have what some people might call girl parts. Some people might call. And of course, you might be a girl even if you have what some people might call boy parts. That was for first graders. Mm. So that's what we're up against now. You know, when I was young, I didn't face these issues until I got to college. But our kids are facing them in undergraduate, elementary school.
Yeah, Nancy, let's end today. And again, we'll come back next time. But let's end today on that description that you gave at the very beginning about the gospel, the creation message, why the fact that we're created in his image, male and female, is so critical to the holistic aspect of the Christian faith and what we believe God intended for us.
Yeah, you know, sometimes people talk about the Christian worldview is like a drama in three acts: creation, fall, redemption. And you want to have all three acts there. Creation means everything was created good. You know, God is a good God, and therefore what he creates is good. And our concepts of human dignity rest on the creation. That's why, you know, as opposed to the secular world, why we uphold a high view of human dignity. The fall is real. So Christians are very realistic about sin and evil. We're not Pollyanna-ish. You know, we're very realistic about that. And redemption means there's hope. You know, not only that there will be a final redemption, but that God is working today redemptively in our lives, that we can see real healing. Francis Schaeffer, since we quoted him, used to say, as Christians, we should expect substantial healing. Not full healing this side of heaven, but we should expect substantial healing. And so what happens is Christians start in the middle of the story. We start with the fall, right? We start with, I just got a call from a youth pastor who said, I didn't know how to do anything except say these things are bad. You know, what sexuality, you know, the hookup culture, homosexuality, transgenderism, all these things. I didn't know how to say anything except don't do it. It's bad. It's against the Bible. He said, your book gave me the language to say, God created the body. It's good. And to start, we have to start our message with creation. It's not just that the Christian worldview has these three acts, but we need to start our message with creation, and then we communicate to people the high view of the human person that is scriptural.
Well, this is so good, Nancy, and what a place to stop, and we'll pick it up again next time, continue our discussion to give people more empowerment when it comes to God's plan for their lives. You know, there's a reason it's body, soul, and spirit. Right? That's how God created us, not just one of the three or two of the three. It's three of the three. And he has a prescription for us to live by that brings us shalom, his peace. And I'm so grateful to you for the hard work, the hard thought process of putting Love Thy Body together. I mean, you are a deep thinker, and I so appreciate the journey that you described that God brought you on.
Thank you.
To bring you to this point and all your great work over the years. Thank you for being with us. And man, I'm telling you, I'm going to be sharing this with my two 20-something sons to read through together and really provide them the tools necessary to understand the battle, the spiritual battle that we are all under when it comes to the attack on the body, the attack on women. And we as the Christian community need to identify it and live to empower men and women, boys and girls, to live up to their created expectation. And I would love to get this into your hands. If you can send us a gift of any amount, monthly is great. It helps us be part of the ministry over the long run. Or a one-time gift, we'll send you Nancy's book as our way of saying thank you for being part of the ministry.
Yeah, donate today and get a copy of this book, Love Thy Body, when you call 800, the letter A in the word family, 800-232-6459. Or you can donate and get the book at FocusOnTheFamily.com. On behalf of the entire team, thanks for joining us for Focus on the Family with Jim Daly. I'm John Fuller, inviting you back as we continue the conversation with Nancy and once again, help you and your family thrive in Christ.
You know, the kids who are gender nonconforming, the ones who don't quite fit and who know they don't and who are feeling gender distress because of it, they are being targeted.
That's professor, author, and speaker Nancy Piercy sharing her perspective that devaluing the body has wreaked havoc in our culture. This is Focus on the Family with Jim Daly, and thanks for joining us. I'm John Fuller, and this episode is once again going to address some mature themes, and so probably not advisable for younger listeners.
That's always a good warning, John. We had a fascinating discussion with Nancy last time about the hidden philosophy that has caused so much heartache and confusion in our culture today. And we talked about how separating from our bodies, kind of that understanding that the soul and the spirit are over here and the body, well, that's up for grabs. And it plays out in different ways in the culture. And Nancy did a beautiful job describing that when it comes to the transgendered issue, the homosexual issue, and even the hookup culture, you know, that I can separate my emotions from my body and the experience of my body. All destructive things that aren't what God intends for us being made in His image, male and female. And today we're going to continue that discussion, go a little deeper. If you missed the discussion last time, go to the website or get the app and you can listen to the full content of that discussion. And again, we'll pick up today and go a little deeper.
Yeah, Nancy Piercy, as I said, is back with us. She's a professor of apologetics and a scholar in residence at Houston Christian University. She's written a number of great books, and the one that forms the foundation for our discussion today is called Love Thy Body, Answering Hard Questions About Life and Sexuality. Get a copy of the book from us here. Call 800-A-FAMILY or stop by focusonthefamily.com.
Nancy, welcome back. Always good to have you.
Thank you. Good to be here.
I so admire your work over the years. You know, we haven't had you here often, but I watch and I read what you put out in articles and, of course, the books that you've written, your association with a wonderful mutual friend, the late Chuck Colson, who was such a deep thinker. I remember having lunch with Chuck Colson. It was so good. And he was talking about the classic literature, as he always did, Plato, Socrates, Aristotle. And, you know, I was tracking with him. I'd read some of those. But he looked at me and said, "You're just like a regular guy, aren't you?" I said, "Yes, I am." He goes, "Stay that way."
Oh.
But I am always intrigued because I think it's so important for us to understand as best as we can a biblical context for the world around us. In fact, we're partnering with the Colson Center on a new documentary film called Truth Rising. It's coming out in September. And this is exactly the kind of thing the film addresses, a biblical worldview and its impact on the culture. Because understanding God's truth about our bodies, our sexuality, the creation, the fall, and redemption, and sharing it with our neighbors is how we fix what's broken in the world. You don't have to be an intellectual. I would put you in that class along with Chuck Colson, but this is for everybody to understand, and it's so wonderful when we have great, deep Christian thinkers who can observe what's happening and give it some context for the rest of us in the church. So I'm very grateful to you for that. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
It's good to have you here in that context. Let me ask you, as the author, let's go right to that, this concept that we talked about last time. Just refresh the thesis, if you will, that what you see is a separation of those contexts of how God created us, the body over here, spirit and soul over here, and how that is wreaking havoc, as John said, through the culture today, and how the LGBT movement is using it, how the abortion rights movement has been using this to kind of separate the body from the rest of God's creation.
You know, I think I'll start with a quote from a book. I think it was the first book to come out on an academic level defending transgenderism. And of course, I have to, like you said, I have to read those guys because what the academics say is what filters down to ordinary people.
And they tend to be trendsetters.
Yes. Yeah. It will filter down. Plato said, philosophers should rule the world, and they do about 200 years after they die.
Yeah, that's really true.
And so that's why it's good to know secular worldviews, because our children are picking up secular worldviews. Whether they're in public school or in Christian school or homeschool, they are picking up, they're absorbing secular ideas. And so we need to train them in how to have a critical grid. But here was an academic Princeton University professor writing a book defending transgenderism. And to my surprise, she first started by acknowledging that transgenderism involves inner division, inner conflict, self-estrangement, self-alienation, you know, because your gender is separate from your biology. But then she said, that doesn't matter. And here's why. She said, because what, this is a direct quote, what the body tells us is nothing. It has no meaning at all.
Wow.
So that's the heart of what's being taught all the way down to first graders today.
Well, think of the juxtaposition of that with Paul saying God's nature is clearly in front of you. I mean, I would suggest Paul is saying the opposite.
He's saying the opposite.
That by observing nature, you see God.
And it's evident to observation that living things are structured for a purpose.
Yeah,
that eyes are for seeing, ears are for hearing, wings are for flying, fins are for swimming. In fact, the development of the entire organism is driven by an inbuilt plan or blueprint, DNA. And so science is on our side when we say our bodies do have a purpose. We are meant to take our identity from our body. We are meant to live in tune with our biological identity. And the sticking point, you know, that we, the thing that we can critique the non-Christian worldview on is that all of these secular worldviews deny the body, denigrate the body. They have a low view of the body. And if your body is meaningless, that's a big part of who you are. No wonder young people are becoming more and more depressed. Mm. They're being told that their body is not, and you know, has no higher purpose or dignity.
Yeah, and again, one of the things we want to do here at Focus is to equip the listeners to be able to have these discussions with people. The secularists, the atheists, the non-God-oriented folks have just been so aggressive getting out there, and the church generally has just somehow like confuse courtesy and kindness with tolerance, and we just kind of back up and we don't confront that. And you don't have to be mean-spirited to confront these things. Confronting something means speak the truth to it and hopefully be equipped. So that's why we're talking with you about these concepts.
Well, it's a lot easier to tell people the Christian worldview if you can say it in a positive way. You know, if you can say, well, we're the Christian ethic is based on honoring your body, living
right
in tune with your body. You know, let me give you
that one. Sounds so positive.
Here's one of my favorite quotes was from a young woman who lived as a lesbian for many years and then became a Christian. And today she's married to a man. You have to say that.
Yeah.
Married to a man and has two kids. And she said, the turning point came when I came to trust that God had made me female for a reason. And I wanted to, this is a direct quote, I wanted to honor my body by living in accord with the Creator's design.
Right.
Okay, that's the positive language. That's how we present it to our kids and to our secular neighbors.
And really, from a Christian perspective, that's an honest person. I remember interviewing someone you know too, Dr. Rosaria Butterfield, mm-hmm. who was a lesbian and taught women's studies at Syracuse University. Delightful. She is a brainiac. Mm-hmm. You know, and she has a PhD in English literature. And she was sitting right where you're sitting. And she said something to me that was so crystal clear. She said, when I was a lesbian and knowing language the way I know language, when I heard that I am living my verb, lesbian, and not my noun made in his image, that made sense to me. And at that moment, I left lesbianism. Mm. How powerful that is, that we as sinners living our verb, whatever it might be, adulterer, lesbian, gay, whatever that might be, but not realizing what our noun is, being made in his image. That is what you're talking about throughout your book.
I have a very similar story in my book, a young woman named Rebecca, who started living as a lesbian in college. And for about 10 years, she became a Christian, but she still had same-sex attractions.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't go away overnight. And she got married.
Sometimes it doesn't go away.
It doesn't. So she discussed it with her husband. And here's what he said. Because God made you a woman, no matter what your feelings are right now, you can be confident that you will be ultimately more fulfilled sexually with a man. And of course, he said, me too. I mean, you know, because God made me as a man, no matter what my feelings might be, I can be confident that I will be ultimately more fulfilled with a woman. And that was the turning point for Rebecca, because it made sense. It's kind of like Rosaria. Yeah, it made sense.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
It dropped into place.
It was logical.
You know, Nancy, let me ask you, because
it took 4 more years, by the way.
Yeah, well, and it takes time. Boy, the Christian journey takes time. But in that context, when you look at the human souls that turn, how much of this is rooted in the same old thing, which is the garden? We want control. We want decision-making power. We don't want to live to God's concepts. it kind of takes us all the way back to the garden, that we'll eat of the tree of knowledge. We'll make the decisions, mm-hmm. God. We know better than you how to live our lives. We know what our sexual orientation is. Has nothing to do with you. There is in the underpinnings of it a whiff of defiance. And that's what makes these things so beautiful, like Rosaria and your friend's story, that it fell into place when their intellect caught up with their soul.
And the trust.
Yeah.
This was one of my students. My book, for anyone who's listening, is not just moral reasoning. It's got lots and lots of stories and anecdotes, especially since I've been teaching. I have a lot of students. This was a student who came to me and said, she had lived as a lesbian for several years, and she said, then I came to trust that God's way would be best. You know, that speaks to what you were saying. You know, is it my choice? Is it my decision? Do I decide what's right and wrong? Do I eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil? Or do I trust that God made me and he knows better?
There is a yielding that's required. Mm-hmm. That's faith, a yielding of your desires over God's creative intentions for us. Let's move to the NPR interview, because this gets back to the book content. We're finally back on track. But NPR, you had an exchange with them. They did an interview with you. Until they asked a question, you gave an answer that it felt like they couldn't handle. But what was that exchange about?
Yeah, so it was an NPR program in San Francisco, which I thought could be challenging anyway.
Right.
But it was a pre-interview where the producer, you know, kind of feels you out, and he asked me about my views on abortion. And he himself commented that most people think abortion is okay until the fetus becomes a person. And I said, well, there's a lot of philosophical baggage in that phrase, because you're assuming that the body, you know, the fetus can be biologically human but not a person. I said, that's a very fragmented view of the human being, a very fractured view that you could somehow divide the person and the body. I said the pro-life view is holistic, because what we're saying is the body participates in the dignity and value of the whole person. And he didn't have an answer. I mean, there's silence. So then I continued. I said the pro-choice view is exclusive. It says some people don't measure up. They don't make the cut. They don't qualify for the status of personhood. I said the pro-life view is inclusive. You know, as long as you remember the human race, you're in.
You have
count.
Dignity.
Mm-hmm. You have the full dignity of a philosophers put it this way. You're part of the moral community, meaning the people who we have a moral commitment
to. Now, isn't that the contradiction for those people that believe they're the all-inclusive people?
Yes.
Yet they're not. And how, I mean, that's difficult. How do you peel those blinders off to say, you're thinking you're inclusive, but you're actually exclusive.
Mm-hmm. I was using liberal buzzwords, you know, like holistic and inclusive. And by the way, the end of that story is a few days later, I got a phone call saying, well, we've decided to cancel that program.
Yeah, there's a little manipulation. Right? We don't want somebody who has a deep thought on this from the other side. You tell a story also in the book of Martin Pistorius. What was significant about his story, and how did that undergird this dignity concept?
He had an unusual case where it's called locked-in syndrome, and that's where your brain can be perfectly alert and alive, but you can't move your body. Mm-hmm. And so he had a coma, and then his brain came alive, but he couldn't move his body. And so people thought he was a vegetable. His parents were advised to just put him away in an institution and forget about him. But his father refused. His father got him up every day and bathed him and fed him and took him to a daycare center, you know, for disabled people. And then his mother, even in a moment of frustration, in his presence, actually said, I wish you would just die. And he heard it. They didn't know. His brain was completely alive and active.
Yeah, he just couldn't communicate.
He just couldn't communicate. It's lockdown syndrome. Anyway, it was finally a very sensitive therapist noticed that he was making very, very slight eye movements and so on. So she had him tested, and to their shock, his brain was completely normal. Mm. And he has since recovered and has a job and is married and is living an almost normal life. But the point is, what if people had said, oh, look, he has no normal functioning. He's not a person. You know, this is where abortion and euthanasia are related. Mm-hmm. Abortion says you're not a person until you have a certain level of cognitive functioning. euthanasia says if you lose a certain level of cognitive functioning, a certain level of mental
ability, below the line.
You are no longer a person. And this is what bioethicists actually argue. They were once a person, but now they are only a body, as one bioethicist put it. And at that point, your treatment can be withheld. Your food and water can be discontinued. Your organs can be harvested. You know,
that was that case of Shivo many years ago, and she was in a vegetative state, they thought, she had eye movement. That may have been very much like this other man, and they did remove her feeding tube, and she passed away.
And she died of
the Christian community fought for her.
And there was a TV program that illustrated the worldview point of Terry Shivo. There was a bioethicist, it was called Court TV. And a bioethicist was asked point blank, do you think Terry is a person? And he said, no, I do not. Mm-hmm. I think self-awareness is crucial to being a person. And so that was the point of issue was, is she a person, or with the loss of many of her cognitive functioning, is she no longer a person? Well, she was obviously still human. Mm-hmm. Nobody argued that she'd become an alien species.
Right.
So that's, again, you can be human and not have human rights.
Nancy, how much of this is rooted in the abortion issue, that since abortion was made legal now, that's been reversed, but not in every state, obviously. It's a state-by-state thing now after the reversal of Roe v. Wade. But how much of this dehumanization is rooted in the way we treat our preborn children? I think it's quite connected.
Well, historically, it started there.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Peter Singer at Princeton, who I've mentioned, he's sort of the person who really popularized the body-person dualism in his book called Practical Ethics, which has been used in every university in America, you know, since the 1970s. I believe that's when he wrote it. And so he's the one who's persuaded whole generations that the fetus is human but not a person, and that as long as it's merely human, it has no rights. And you're right, that same reasoning then comes up everywhere.
Yeah.
You know, if in our laws.
These things are all interlocked, and that's what we need to understand as Christians, and they are philosophically connected by those that oppose a Christian view.
And legally, you know, people say, well, why don't you just let people believe whatever they want to believe? Well, when the laws are changed, it affects everyone.
Right.
You know, so Roe v. Wade, the court essentially said, some humans are not persons. You know, and who decides then? Well, ultimately, whoever has the most power, you know, the state decides. Marriage, people used to think that marriage is a pre-political right. It's natural that men and women come together and form families. But you know what the reasoning was in the Supreme Court decision legalizing same-sex marriage, the Obergefell decision? It argued that we need to acknowledge the personhood of same-sex people. Mm-hmm. And that means giving them, that means not paying attention to the biological connection, you know,
right. Like discard
sex.
The body.
Yeah, discard the body, the biological correspondence.
So it reinforced that issue.
And that it's just a matter of emotional connection.
Yeah.
And then the Bostock decision was transgender decision 2020. Again, the court basically said your personhood is what you choose. If you choose that you're a woman, if you choose you're a man, then legally that's what we recognize. We do not recognize you. Your body is no longer legally recognized.
Wow.
They don't
think
care.
Of that.
Mm. And then the final one was parenthood. Parenthood, I think, is the most influential, and that is the Pavan decision in 2017, I think. I don't remember exactly. It's in the book. There was a decision about same-sex parents. So in same-sex couples, at least one parent is not biologically related to the child.
Right.
And so that person's name did not go on the birth certificate until this Supreme Court decision where they said, well, as long as you're legally married, then you qualify as a parent. So now you're not a parent because you're biologically related to your child. You're a parent if the state says you are. Mm-hmm. So essentially, the state has redefined parenthood apart from biology.
Yeah, wow.
So all
these are
of these
big,
legal
big things. Yeah.
All of these legal decisions rest on separating, saying the body, biology doesn't matter.
Yeah. Nancy, again, these things are also interlinked. I want to move to the biggest issue of the culture right now, it seems, is this issue of transgenderism. You know, one of the things that someone had mentioned to me, and I, you know, people need to check this out because I haven't had the time yet, but the DSM-4, the Diagnostic Psychological Tool, which I think we're up to the DSM-5 now or maybe even 6, but you go back a few years, and these are the tools that psychologists will use, counselors will use. There was an association with eating disorder and transgenderism. They were in the same category, I think the way it was described to me, under this issue of control. You get to bulimia and anorexia. It's this fixation on controlling your body. And the same is true with transgenderism. You are trying to control your body to be female or to be male. And there was linkage there. Well, you know, without any science, boom, it's gone. In DSM-5, they just delinked it, probably for political reasons. And now it's okay. You're not in a mental disorder state, according to the DSM-5 now. And you look at all that and you're going, what is happening? And you have a story in the book with Brandon, who had this issue of gender dysphoria. Describe his story and what you caught out of that.
Yeah, I love to tell his story because it gives parents some sense of practically, you know, what do we do? So Brandon was a young boy who clearly had gender dysphoria from a very young age.
And actually, it exists.
And that was the more traditional form of it. Back when it was called transsexualism, it was almost purely male, and it was usually very young. And so he was the classic case. Before he was even walking, when he was still crawling, his babysitter said to his mother, "He's too good to be a boy," by which she meant he was sweet, gentle, compliant, and the things we normally associate with girls. And when he was in preschool, when his mother picked him up, invariably he was playing with the little girls and not the little boys. Already in elementary school, he was coming to his parents weeping and saying, "I don't fit anywhere. You know, the boys like sports and video games. Girls like emotions and relationships." And he said, "I like what girls like. You know, I'm interested in the things girls are. God should have made me a girl." And this is it's very painful. He, by the time he was in his early teens, he was looking on the internet for a sex reassignment surgery. So what did his parents do? First of all, they made sure he knew that they loved him just the way he was. They did not try to change him. I have a friend who is a former homosexual, and he said, "When I was young, I liked music and art. And my father was baffled and kept trying to toughen me up by pushing me into sports and other more traditionally masculine activities." But Brandon's parents didn't do that. They said it's perfectly okay to be a gentle, sensitive, emotional boy. It does not mean you're really a girl. And they said it could be that God has gifted you for one of the caring professions, like counselor, psychologist, healthcare worker. And of course, it's also okay for a girl to be gender nonconforming, to be more rational or interested in some STEM subjects. What his parents' favorite line, which they said over and over again, was, "It's not you that's wrong, it's the stereotypes that are wrong." They took him through the gifts of the Spirit. Prophecy and teaching are not masculine, as we might expect, and mercy and service are not feminine. You know, the text says that the Holy Spirit distributes them to individuals as he wills. And the fruit of the Spirit is not divided into pink boxes and blue boxes either. Brandon had a difficult time. You know, 80 to 90%, depending on the study, of kids with gender dysphoria outgrow it in puberty.
Right.
With the rush of hormones.
I mean, you need to say that. I mean, I've used that stat.
Yeah.
80% of gender dysphoric preteen and teens will come to the correct gender assignment by the time they're 18, 19 years old.
They'll accept their natal sex.
Yeah, their natal sex. I mean,
but
that's a big statement because that's where the politics of this gets really messy, because now you're recruiting these kids that would have normally grown out of their gender dysphoria. 80%. And we're trapping them in, recognizing that 10 to 20% might have a truly lifelong issue. But man, do you want to trap 80% of the kids for 20% of the issue?
Well, Brandon did not change.
Right, okay.
He was a tougher case, but he went into about his mid-20s. And then he finally concluded that, here's how he put it. He said, surgery would not give me what I want. It would not make me a girl. There's a very famous TED Talk by a cardiologist, and the famous line from it is, every cell has a sex. Mm-hmm. Every cell has a DNA that's either masculine or feminine.
XX, XY.
Obviously, you cannot change every cell in your body. Although the way Brandon put it was, a person is not a computer disk that you can erase and start over again.
Yeah. You know, Nancy, so much, and I've been thinking about this and writing about it myself, but so much of what we're talking about seems to be spiritual warfare toward women specifically. And when you look at transgenderism particularly, I'm thinking of that court case in California recently where a biological male who claimed to be a female was moved from a male prison to a female prison. And this person was in prison originally for sexual assault. And so when they moved him to a female prison, he was sexually abusing his prison cellmate, a woman. And she was complaining to the guards that they needed to help her to get her to safety because she was being sexually abused. And they said, if you're not careful, we're going to slap hate crimes on top of your other crimes. Think of this poor woman, you know, who is serving her time, whatever she did, I don't even know. But this fact that they were putting her in harm's way, the emotional trauma of that, and that really, to me, illustrates this war against women, particularly in this area of gender dysphoria. So I guess the question is, how does abolishing biological sex harm women, even in your illustrations, and then ultimately all of us when it comes to universal human rights?
Yes. Well, fortunately, some feminists have picked up on this issue because they recognize that if you cannot define what a woman is, then you cannot give them legal protection. You know, you cannot legally protect a category of people if you cannot define that category.
Mm-hmm. And that's what they're tripping on. It's getting nonsensical.
And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of feminists do go along with the transgender. If you call something a right, they'll say, oh, we're for it. But there are, they're sometimes called gender-critical feminists who are pointing out that the law is essentially being changed in such a way that you cannot defend women's rights. I'm actually in a group. It's called Hands Across the Aisle. And we have a public presence, but we also have a private presence so that we can talk to each other. And it's a group of conservative Christian women and very radical, liberal, socialist, many of them lesbian, women.
Okay.
And we're coming together behind the scenes and writing sample legislation, writing op-ed pieces, and working together on this trans issue because they recognize that women's rights are at stake. You know, they've been called TERFs. Have you heard that term? T-E-R-Fs.
Tell me what it is.
Trans Exclusionary Radical Feminist. T-E-R-F. Okay. It's meant as a slur.
Trans exclusionary, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But yet, these are the feminists who have recognized that they've been fighting for women's rights all their lives, and now they can't even say the word woman.
Mm-hmm. You know, well, and that's kind of the pretzel I'm talking about. Is this a spiritual observation that kind of the logic of those that aren't coming from a God-created perspective, is it starting to fall in on itself? Are we seeing the implosion of worldly secular views that are beginning to make no sense because of the infighting between the L, the G, the T, the B. I mean, you know, that there's this division now created in the philosophy.
Yeah, it's really cool to see that division in some ways because there's a group that's calling themselves LGB. We are not T. Have you seen them?
Right, they're separating themselves.
We're LGB. Or there's a group called Gays Against Groomers.
Right.
And they're also the ones who are against grooming kids into a transgender identity because schools are doing that. More and more schools are the ones. When it was new, young people were coming, they were getting drawn into the transgender movement from the internet, you know, from TikTok and so on. But now, more and more, the stories are, I got it at school. You know, at school, I was introduced to the idea that I might be transgender, that I might be the opposite sex. Schools have changing rooms. What's that mean? That means you can come dressed as a boy, but you can change into girls' clothes and your parents don't need to know it.
Mm-hmm.
And they can refer them to therapists who are transgender friendly and who will encourage the students. And as you know, a lot of the debate has been over, can they encourage kids to transition without telling their parents? Can they change their names, their pronouns, their clothes, and all of that without telling their parents? They'll use their child's real name if the parent's there to deceive them.
Yeah.
And then use the child's chosen name, you know, at school. So that's the cutting edge, is where they're actually deceiving parents.
Oh, exactly. And, you know, again, an obvious question to ask is, does that pass the smell test? Is that the way public schools should be operating? Mm-hmm. And obviously the answer is no. Whenever there's deception or secrecy or hiding, that typically is fruit of the other guy. Right? That's what it says, right, in Galatians, that he's the master of division and lying and cheating and those kinds of things. Those are attributes of the enemy of our soul. And so we should plainly see that as Christians and understand that when things are being done in secret, in darkness, that's fruit of satanic spirit.
That should be a huge red flag right there.
Huge red flag. Let me at the end here, let me just ask you, you know, because there are these serious issues that people struggle with. Again, what we would call in the DSM-4, mental disorder. So for the parents that might be struggling with sincere difficulties, how do you suggest they navigate these things? I mean, that's a huge question, but what is fluff and what is real?
Well, the cool thing is that now we have the growing numbers of detransitioners.
Right.
And this is great because they can tell us they've been there and back. And many of them say, I had emotional, psychological issues that were not dealt with. I was, you know, fast-tracked into transitioning, and they are now coming back. They're suing the clinics.
Yeah.
And as you know, about 25 states now have actually passed laws against medical interventions, puberty blockers, cross-sex hormones and surgeries for minors, 25 states. So,
well, and in part because Europe has recognized, yes, that it does more harm than good. And I certainly applaud Europe for looking at the data, mm-hmm, right? Let's give them a hand clap for looking at it and saying, okay, we're going to stop intervening.
Yeah, and it's partly because they allowed it earlier. So they've seen it for a longer time.
Correct. And so but we are not coming to that same conclusion in the U.S., which, again, now kind of works against science.
Sweden had the longest study, and yeah, they found that young people who transitioned did not do better, that their suicide rates were actually higher. Mm. But detransitioners, let me give you one story. So there's a girl who, I read her interview, she had transitioned to a boy identity at age 11, has lived as a trans boy for 3 years, and then at age 14 reclaimed her identity as a girl. And here's what she said. The turning point came when I realized, direct quote, it's not conversion therapy to learn to love your body.
Huh. Mm-hmm.
And I thought, even the secular people are seeing this, because this was on a very secular liberal website.
Yeah.
And even secular people are beginning to say that. You'll see them calling it transgender ideology is body hatred. Or they'll say transgender ideology is biology denial. The first study ever done was by Lisa Littman at Brown University. She did the first study on rapid onset gender dysphoria. That is, you know, I said that the traditional version of transgenderism starts very young. But here we were having these teenage girls who had no sign of gender dysphoria when they were young and suddenly deciding they were the opposite sex. Yeah. So they had to have a new name for it. So they called it rapid onset gender dysphoria. And she did the first study, this professor at Brown University. And here's what she found. 63% of these young girls had previously diagnosed mental or emotional disorders. In other words, you know, most teenagers have some anxiety and depression.
Sure, right.
But these were young girls whose issues were serious enough that they'd been taken to a therapist and been diagnosed. And it was anxiety, depression, and OCD, and
your more typical clinical diagnoses, yeah.
A whole host of them, ADHD and bipolar, a whole host of them. And so, the conclusion from that is these are very fragile kids. Mm. You know, here's the application. If you're dealing with these children in your family, in your church, in your classroom, they are very emotionally fragile kids.
Yeah.
And so they do need to be treated with gentleness and care. And frankly, I think that as Christians, another practical rule is we need to be going out of our way to find these kids because they are being targeted. You know, the kids who are gender nonconforming, the ones who don't quite fit and who know they don't and who are feeling gender distress because of it, they are being targeted. I have a niece who was homeschooled until about fifth grade, and then when she went to public school, the kids said, "You're gay. You're lesbian." She says, "No, I'm not." "Yes, you are."
Like, yeah.
In other words, she was a little bit more masculine in her presentation. And so, well, she wasn't from a Christian family, so she finally decided maybe they were right. And now she's a lesbian. But she was targeted by her classmates.
Right. Mm-hmm. Recruited.
Recruited. And another niece, by the way, my brother's daughter, same thing. She was 11 years old. And she said, the kids are constantly asking each other, "Are you gay? Are you trans?" Because it's cool now. You know, nobody wants to be a boring old heterosexual.
Right.
It's cool. And you are. There are schools where at least 50% are non-binary. Because non-binary is the safest one. Right? There's nothing to defend.
Yeah.
So that's the most common non-binary.
And, you know, this is a serious look at all of this. Bill Maher, you know, I saw a clip of him a while back who was making the observation as someone who leans left, right? Bill Maher was saying, "Did anybody notice at the New York Gay Pride Parade, there were no gay people on the podium? It was all transgendered people." And, you know, the audience laughed, but he was making an observation that is so true. Mm-hmm. I mean, again, this is the culture we're living in. And Nancy, you've done a great job. We are at the end, but you've done a great job pulling this together, this thought that the body is consequential in our understanding of God's creation of us. And it's connected to every part. Body, soul, and spirit. And the Lord intends for us, particularly as believers, to love thy body and understand the creation of the body and what it's meant for, and to the best of our ability to be able to speak that message to a world that is kind of disoriented now to this concept of your body being made in his image, male and female. And so I'm so grateful to you for re-enlightening us and talking about these core themes, your experiences as a professor. Thank you for being with us.
Oh, thank you. It's been a joy.
It's so good. And I hope this is intriguing enough and thoughtful enough that you want a copy of the book. And if you order that through Focus, not the big retailers, all the proceeds go right back into helping families. That we don't pay those shareholders. Those dollars will go right back into helping families thrive in Christ. And so help us be part of the ministry, make a gift of any amount, or make a monthly gift and a commitment that way. That's how Gene and I support the ministry. If you do that, we'll send you a copy of Nancy's book as our way of saying thank you for being part of the ministry.
Yeah, donate generously as you can today and request that book when you call 800, the letter A and the word family, 800-232-6459. We'll have further details and links to additional articles that really relate to this topic at the website, and you'll find those links at focusonthefamily.com. Thanks for joining us today for Focus on the Family with Jim Daly. I'm John Fuller, inviting you back as we once again help you and your family thrive in Christ.